Catherine Spires with Smart Mouth. This week, our guest is someone who, I don't care what country you live in, you've probably seen her on TV because she's been a contestant on Top Chef US and Top Chef Mexico. Hi, Claudette.
Hi.
It's Claudette Zepeda-Wilkins. Yes. So many people, do you get recognized a lot? I feel like in San Diego, you've got people who've probably seen you on the US and Mexico versions.
Yeah. Yeah. In New Orleans, even, I got stopped a couple times. I have a look, you know, it's the glasses that usually give it away.
Oh, okay.
I did an experiment where I took them off and walked into a bar for an opening of a restaurant in San Diego. Not one person, people that I've known for 10 years, nobody realized it was me. I put them on after my eyes got tired of my contacts and they're like, you've been here the whole time.
Oh my God. Whoops. So. That's hilarious. And right now you are opening your own restaurant.
I am. Yes. I'm not going to jinx it, but it's coming soon. We're thinking last week of April, first week of May, but you know.
It always takes longer than you think, right? Yep. Yeah. And then what part of San Diego is that? We're called El Jardin.
Yes. El Jardin. It's located in the Point Loma area in the historic Liberty Station. So 100-year-old building. That used to sell uniforms is being converted into a restaurant, which is why it's taking so long.
Yeah. Well, it sounds charming as heck. Yeah. I don't know San Diego at all, but it sounds delightful.
It is. It's super quaint.
Good, good. So what kind of food would you say that you cook?
Comfort food.
Comfort food.
Soul food.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense then that your dish of choice for this episode was chicken tikka masala.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it's one of those really like warming dishes.
Yeah.
That everyone just like wants to eat an enormous bowl full of.
Yeah, for sure.
It's so hard to stop eating it.
With garlic naan.
Garlic naan. See, I go plain naan.
Oh, no. I like extra garlic, like loaded up. But there's only one place I eat tikka at in San Diego, and it's really, really good tikka masala.
Yeah? Do you want to give it a shout out, or are you going to keep it secret?
No, it's Punjabi Tandoor. It's in a commercial area. You probably feel like you're going to get murdered if you go at night, but it's so good. It's this tiny hole in the wall, like a deli, and ran by a family, really grumpy daughter that does the cashier. She throws money at me when she gives me my change. It makes me feel bad about myself. But it's so good and I keep going back.
Glutton for punishment. It must be amazing.
It is really good.
That's do you ever order anything else on the menu?
No, I usually order one of everything. So they have like the lunch tray where you can get like the tikka, the sag paneer, the dal, and you can kind of get a little like a roundabout.
I see.
Through everything, and then I'll get a side of tikka because the leftover tikka masala is just as good.
Oh my God, yes, yes. Do you like it spicy or not?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You go for spice.
Yeah.
I don't.
Well, because I don't eat, so people think that I eat like rice and beans every day at home because I cook Mexican food.
Oh, okay.
So I like eating flavors that I'm familiar with as far as like profile spices. Uh-huh. And Mexico has a lot of Middle Eastern spices, Asian spices that all kind of encompass the entire country.
Yeah.
So I am familiar with these spices in my context. So it's nice to see them in a different culture's context.
Ah.
It's just a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. Have you ever cooked tikka masala?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, biryani chicken. Uh-huh. Chicken biryani, I think. I butcher the pronunciation. Butter chicken is also my favorite.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And butter chicken and chicken tikka masala are pretty similar.
Yeah.
As foods go.
Yeah.
I'm sure someone just heard that and was like, how dare you?
Yeah. Yeah. To me, I don't make the butter chicken spicy. And tikka is always spicy for me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Before we get too deep into it, I forgot. I wanted to respond to a listener letter. This one came in on Twitter from E. Tong. And they were talking about the Xiaolong Bao episode that we ran a couple, well, when this airs, it'll be like a month and a half ago, I think, with Anthony Kailan. And E. Tong was wondering if we like the fancy kind of soupy dumplings where they actually add black truffles to the top. Now, you are a fan of soupy dumplings or Xiaolong Bao or whatever you want to call it, because how could you not be?
Yes.
They're so good.
Yeah.
Have you ever had them when they're all gussied up?
I actually am not a huge fan of truffles.
Me either.
I think they're like, it's okay. It's had its moment. We can let them go now.
Yes.
I don't want to pay that much for that.
It is so much money for a bit of fungus.
Yeah. Like, I mean, granted, I pay a shit ton for ant larva, but at least I can flavor it with garlic and shallots and butter. Like, it's got flavor, depth of flavor. Yeah. And truffles is just truffle. It's like, okay.
I feel like it overpowers everything else on the plate.
Yeah.
And truffles in and of themselves, fine, whatever. But truffle oil, that's really evil. We should tell everyone that truffle oil doesn't have truffles in it.
No, absolutely not. It's just disgusting. This,
like, chemical. Essence.
Yeah, like alcohol. It's the same as if you go get vanilla at Bond's. It's not vanilla. I promise you it's not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm sorry if we just, like, ruined anyone's secret recipe or something like that. But my goodness, it just is like a bunch of, like, man-made chemicals.
Yeah. Yeah, you might as well go to Bath and Body Works and then spray, like, champagne and strawberry all over your fucking potato chips. Like,
my God.
It's the same thing. That's not really strawberries and champagne.
Yes. Oh, so upsetting.
Put it all over your potatoes.
So, anyway, the answer to the question is that Xiaolong Bao, you got to go traditional, right?
Yeah.
Just like the pork, maybe the seafood.
Yeah.
Why gild the lily?
Yeah, no. And in like a super divey dim sum place too. Okay. Like where the ladies mean to you. Yeah, that's...
There's a theme here. You're super into ladies being mean to you.
I like it. I dig it.
It like works up an appetite in you, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you feel like you need their approval. It's like, I miss my grandma, so I want someone to be mean to me. I don't know. Maybe that's what it is.
Awesome. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I feel you on that. Oh, goodness. So back to chicken tikka masala. Let's talk about like what it is. There's a lot of ingredients in this dish. You could put turmeric, coriander, cumin, ginger, the tomatoes, mm-hmm. of course. You could put in cardamom, any chilies that you want, cilantro. Mm-hmm. Does that all sound right?
Yeah. Coconut milk.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you do it with coconut milk?
I do coconut milk.
Oh, interesting.
I had a little bit of coconut milk. I am lactose intolerant, so try to always sub it with something, but I do coconut cream too. Mm. The like Trader Joe's, I hate to plug it in, but like the health... The like cream, it's like super clotted and thick.
Yeah.
So it gives you the feeling of heavy cream.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. And that flavor profile is still going to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Do you make your own garam masala?
No.
I mean, that would take a lot
but
of
time.
But I
do have some amazing garam masala and Ras El Hanout from Morocco that I got when I went and had my Eat, Pray, Love trip.
Oh.
So I have a whole stack of spices from Morocco.
Fun.
Yeah.
Where else did you go? Was Morocco the eating or the praying or the loving?
The eating and loving. Ooh. I like stayed. It was supposed to be the 3 days. I stayed a week.
Okay.
Yeah. I had the Riyadh all to myself. It was so we did Barcelona, Portugal, and Morocco. My friend did her version of it, and I did mine where I just stuck with the owner of the Riyadh, and I said, take me to where your chef shops.
Oh, fun.
And I looked, they thought I was Indian.
Oh, okay.
So, and I always covered myself, you know, respectful of the culture. And they saw brown hair and big brown eyes, and they're like, she's fine, she's Indian.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I've gotten away with that in Tanzania, too. They called me Mahindi. So they don't know Mexico is its own thing.
Oh, okay. That seems kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like very Carmen San Diego.
Yeah.
Awesome.
My adventures.
yeah, that sounds great. So you sub in the coconut instead of like the dairy, and mm-hmm. then do you put in like some lemon juice or something to tart it up a little bit?
At the very end.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
So that's basically what it is. You start with like the grilled chicken from the chicken tikka,
mm-hmm.
and then you add all the sauces to it, and you marinate mm-hmm. it, and you serve it with... Oh, here's the thing that... Americans do that. I believe in India they think we're tacky for doing it. When we eat Indian food and we eat both rice and naan, they're like, calm down.
Well, it's like, I mean, I can't really say anything. Have you ever seen the tamal torta?
No.
So they put a tamal inside of a baguette of a small roll, the torta bread.
Yeah,
it's called a guajolote, which is means turkey. And you almost choke as you're eating it, but it's like a tradition in Mexico City. So yeah. I'm no one to talk starch on starch.
I feel like I could feel my mouth getting all dry as you said that. Yeah. That sounds like you'd have to have so much water.
No. I mean, we eat pasta, we eat fideo, which is that like mm-hmm. vermicelli type of noodle with tortillas. We're just... I'm not going to say anything.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't have a leg to stand on as far as... I'm sure the Indian culture would think we're stupid too.
I mean, white people dip pizza in ranch dressing, so we all do weird shit.
Yeah.
A lot of people just accept the idea that chicken tikka masala is British.
Yeah.
It's not right. really. Yeah. But now we have to start talking about British and Indian history, which is painful.
And long.
In a long, a lot of ways. Yeah, it's long. So much evil was done. What are you going to do? That's the history of the planet, I guess. So it's such a common idea that chicken tikka masala is British that the Encyclopedia Britannica even calls it, quote, a common British dish. It's for sure common in Britain, but I think that's different than it being a British dish.
Like, it's not spotted dick. Like, you're not going to eat.
Like, I bet it's way more popular than spotted dick.
It's just not as fun to say.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much to be said for marketing. It's so important. Even if it's upsetting marketing. Because then you get all the tourists who come in and they're like, oh, I wonder what spotted dick is. It's gross. I'm going to order it. And then they get it and they're like, oh, it's dessert. Okay. Fine. But they've already paid for it. So it doesn't matter. So there's this story that's told in England, well, I guess all of Britain, about like, there, it was like raining one night in Glasgow and a bus driver had just finished his shift and he went to order a chicken curry and it was brought to him and he started eating it and he didn't like it. He thought it was too dry. So he sent it back and it just so happened that like family meal at that restaurant that night was tomato soup. And so the guy who owned the restaurant was like, okay, if you think this is dry, just add tomato soup to it. And voila, chicken tikka masala was invented.
Did he name it too?
I mean, it raises more questions than it answers, right? It doesn't make any sense. Like, think about if you just put chicken curry in canned tomato soup. That it wouldn't taste disgusting. Good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is clearly not what happened. Yeah. No. But it's a story that people love to tell. So let's like go back to when this really all began, which I think you could say it was 1600 when the adventurers working under the banner of Queen Elizabeth I from England got to India and were like, let's have this. This is ours now.
This is ours now. It's the Columbus way. Got it. Yeah, yes.
Exactly. And what's so interesting about the way that Britain kind of worked its way into controlling India through a sideways path was that it was the private companies who went in there to make money and then also started private militias.
Well, yeah, contracting of the 1600s.
Yeah.
Military mercenaries.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I just think it's so interesting that it was sort of like a para-governmental operation. It didn't come straight from the government. It came from traders. They started the violence, which, I mean, I know this all makes sense. Like, missionaries were the ones who started the violence in Hawaii. I didn't know that it wasn't, like, straight orders from the queen to go take it over.
Yeah. It's like their own Vikings, basically.
Yeah.
Land Vikings.
Yeah, totally. Just, like, running roughshod over the world, doing whatever they wanted. So the British East India Company would set up outposts around India. They would hire people to be mercenaries for them. The thing about it is that they sometimes would wild out too much to the point where it even upset the British government. They'd be like, you killed too many people this week or whatever it was. So over the course of time, the British government did start to control more of India by themselves because they would like take permissions away from people or they would revoke charters or give someone else a different charter, that sort of thing. It was really all over the place. Between 1600 and 1858, when the crown, the British crown, officially took control of India.
Became the, what is it, what are they called? When they, the Commonwealth?
Yes.
It became a Commonwealth?
Yes, it became part of the Commonwealth, and that was Queen Victoria became Empress of India. Mm-hmm. Which, if I could just decide that I was an empress, I would do that for sure.
I'm an empress of my house.
Yeah, exactly. I'm actually starting a podcast network, and when you start a business, you can give yourself any title you want. So with the paperwork, I was like, CEO? And no one can tell me I'm not CEO. Yeah. It's like I'm drunk with power right now.
Yeah.
I'm a CEO. I'm very important.
I have a desk plaque thing that says I'm CEO, bitch.
Yeah.
I'm a chef, but it's fun to have that there and people.
And you know, if you come in hot like that, no one's going to disagree.
Yeah. No, I get it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so we're dealing with the British Raj. That's what they called it when they were officially in control of India, the Raj. They were still in control during World War II. Then in 1947, after World War II was officially over, India, which what was considered India still contained what is now considered Pakistan.
Okay.
And everyone was just murdering each other constantly. The war did not end. I understand that fighting stopped in Europe, but clearly, like, the world was still at war.
Yeah. There were still differences.
Yeah, people were fighting all over the place. So a movement really did begin to separate India and Pakistan. Now, there was so many different people who had an investment in making this happen. And what's interesting is that we always hear about Mahatma Gandhi and his nonviolent methods.
Yeah.
But at the same time that he was preaching nonviolence, there were a lot of freedom fighters actively fighting. And who's to say which one was more effective?
Yeah.
Really. It's kind of the same way that we talk more about Martin Luther King, but actually the Black Panthers were doing a lot too.
Hey, shout out to Government Cheese. Black Panther started WIC.
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I benefited from that 15 years
so
ago.
So many people did. And you know, it's hard because when there's people who like lived in the same lifetime as like your parents or your grandparents, we know so much more about their personal life than like whoever. Like, we don't know what Jesus' personal life was, right? So you can just like assign whatever stories. But some of the people who led the Black Panthers were like really bad people.
Yeah.
In terms of like individuals that they came in contact with in their personal lives. But they straight up were all about actually feeding children.
Yep.
They didn't want children to go hungry, and they put, as you mentioned, they put programs into place to feed children.
They went in the inner cities and changed it.
Yeah. School lunches, school breakfasts, all that kind of stuff.
You can't just do evil. Like, you have to do some good.
Right.
The world needs balance.
Yeah, we really all do contain multitudes. It's pretty wild. Anyway.
Like Despicable Me? No? The movie?
You know, see, you've got kids, so you're a lot more familiar with this. I kind of know what you're talking about. There's Minions.
Yes.
But...
Well, they're half evil, half good.
Ah.
It's like a Sour Patch thing.
Ah.
First they're sour, then they're sweet.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's some pretty heavy philosophy in those cartoons.
You know, it's just dropping knowledge bombs.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So it was decided by whatever powers that be that the subcontinent was going to be partitioned into two different areas. So this is called the partition. It was meant to happen over a period of a few years. And this was kind of to give people time to move because they were sort of separating it into India, which was going to be majority Hindu, and Pakistan, which was going to be majority Muslim. But that's not necessarily where people were already living. Like, they were all intermingled, and they were told, if you want to be with your people, you got to either stay put or move, depending.
Yeah.
So it was supposed to happen over a few years to give people time, ostensibly. But then... Lord Mountbatten, who, if anyone watches The Crown, is Uncle Dickie.
Obsessed.
Yeah. Do you know who Uncle Dickie is? Do you know that in real life he's married to Emma Thompson?
The actor?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. But when I learned that, I was like, well, congratulations to you both. That is hot.
Yeah, Mountbatten. I binge watched The Crown in one day.
I mean, who didn't?
It was so good.
Yeah. So good. You know what's funny is that there's a Masterpiece show on right now.
I watched it too.
Victoria?
Well, yeah, I'm like four episodes in because I have to do it in between. I unplug my brain. And
right.
I'm like, I just want to binge watch. I'm obsessed with the monarchy.
Well, obsessed. Yes. It's so interesting. I think Elizabeth was something like Victoria's great-great-grandniece or something like that. But both stories are about powerful women and their kind of diaper baby husbands
who
like couldn't deal with being married to a powerful woman.
Yeah.
There's a lot of overlap. I think The Crown is so much better.
Yeah. And I like the acting. It's really good acting.
I know.
The stories are really good.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I do like the guy who plays Prince Albert in Victoria. He's just such a weirdo.
Yeah.
I'm into it.
Well, I keep thinking that, and then I think of Dirty Things when I hear Prince Albert.
Well, you know, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
Have you ever come across the Prince Albert?
No.
In your journeys? Me neither.
I'm still looking.
You know, part of the reason that whenever people make movies about Queen Victoria, that they're always so lusty is because she was a prolific letter writer and so was Albert. And they wrote real nasty shit to each other.
It's like the original 50 Shades.
Yes. They were
50 Shades
freaks.
Of Gingham.
If We didn't know by the fact that they had, I think, 10 children.
Yeah.
Like, they also wrote about all the freak nasty stuff they were going to do to
each
other.
That happened in making new kids. Yeah. It's amazing. Look, kids, we left you mementos.
Yeah.
Like, read these.
Well, so one of their daughters burned a bunch of the letters.
I would, too.
Prudish of her.
Eyes off, too. Like,
I mean, I get it. But I'm glad that some of them were preserved so that we don't have to think that, like, fancy people don't hit it, too.
They do it behind a curtain.
Yeah, exactly. And then write about it. Good heavens, madam. Anyway, okay, moving ahead in history 100 years. So Uncle Dickie actually decided, like, one night, he was like, actually, we're going to do the partition now. Like literally now. Yes. So that left everyone on the subcontinent just sort of like, what? And moving in a panic, like, straight up, like, moving with one suitcase. So the resulting genocide that happened because of the way humans are, more people died in that than had died in the Holocaust.
Wow.
Which, that's only as a point of reference, not to, like, one up anybody or anything like that. Just because we always
talk about it. But we never talk about it.
Exactly.
You never hear about it.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's interesting and horrifying. Punjab. Mm-hmm. Which is area, like, it's an Indian state that butts up against present day Pakistan, which was West Pakistan at the time. There was a lot of violence focused there. And that might be why so many of the, what we call Indian restaurants in the Western world are Punjabi, because so many people had to leave.
Yeah.
And
that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So that's when we say Indian food, that's pretty much what we're thinking.
Yeah.
Usually is Punjabi food specifically. And chicken tikka masala certainly is the closest related to that tradition.
Yeah. Like, we call chai, isn't that just means tea?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's an empty word to them. They're like, okay.
I know. And knowing that is weird, though, because every time, I don't really drink coffee, so if I'm going to a coffee shop or whatever, I'll get, like, an iced chai, and I always feel stupid saying it.
Silly American. Because
they should be like, what kind of tea, though?
But, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whatever. It's, I don't know, I'm sure that people have done thinking on this before, but it's interesting that so many people, when they have to immigrate to another country, they start restaurants. Mm-hmm. I think about that in terms of Los Angeles, because Los Angeles is not friendly towards new business. It takes so much capital and so much work to start a new business. So it's like the struggle never ends.
And it's so condensed. Like, there's 100 restaurants within a 2-block radius.
Ah.
Like, I don't know how people do it in LA.
Really?
I'm in San Diego. It's a lot. It's a big city, but it's like everyone kind of gets their shot.
Oh,
you know, it's okay. We don't have crazy name, like, big names coming in where the, you're like, fuck, David Chang's coming. Yeah. Goodbye, business. Like, that's what I would think. Like, oh, man.
Oh, interesting.
I can't keep up. Like, you know, you don't have that fear that some other person's going to come and, like, kind of steal your thunder or you be the hot spot and then you're crickets. But I think LA is just, there's so much. There's so much.
Yeah, there really is.
Yeah.
And I was reading something about how many women are food vendors.
Yeah.
It's like 80% of food vendors.
Here in LA?
Yeah, are women. Here's a fact for all the listeners. LA has more, like, freestanding food vendors than per capita than any other city in America, but it's also the only major city where it is illegal to be serving food out of not a brick and mortar restaurant. We get real confused.
They passed a law, was it in Oakland, where they allowed, like, the cart vendors?
I'm not sure.
I think it was Oakland, just recently. Like, they said, okay, because the fight started with a elote vendor on a little cart that got beat up, and the cops took his money.
Oh, I saw that outside, like, a Berkeley game or something like that,
the
right?
Yeah, the cops harassed him,
yeah. Yeah, and literally stole his money.
Yeah.
Cops are wild. Like, they knew they were being filmed, and they still took his money.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Anyway, well, I mean, I guess, like, I feel bad for him, that guy that happened to, but it's nice that they, like, got their heads out of their butts in regards.
Yeah.
People love elote.
Yeah.
Like, no one's ever going to stop selling it on the corner. No one's ever going to stop buying it.
Yeah, that cop, like, I don't know, someone shit in his Cheerios that morning. Like, why would you stop the selling of corn? Like,
I know. Like, get a life.
Yeah.
You know? My God. Anyway, okay, so To give some like stats about the way that the subcontinent changed, let's see. So Karachi Karachi was what became the first capital of Pakistan, and in 1941 it was almost 50% Hindu in that city. By the end of the 40s, there were like almost no Hindus left in Karachi because they had all left. Almost entirely. The flip side of that is Delhi, which was now the capital of India, had been a third Muslim in 1941. By 1949, there were only 200,000 Muslim. Oh no, sorry. 200,000 Muslims had been made to leave.
Wow.
They were like, get out. You know, it's weird how panicky and insular people get so quickly. We're really quick to do that.
Have you seen that show, The Eagle? Was it the Eagle and the Man in the Eagle's Nest, or what's the name? It's on Amazon Prime.
The Man
High Castle. The Man in the High Tower. Castle.
Or Castle.
Castle.
Okay.
Because it's about Hitler.
Yes, but if Hitler had won.
Yeah. Yeah. So that it reminds me of that because in the Japanese country part of California, there was like Jews that weren't gonna get killed, but they had to be practiced basically in under wraps, close all their windows,
like forced conversion, crusade style nonsense. Yeah, I didn't keep watching that show because I was like, I am creeped out and bored.
It's very confusing.
Not a good combo. It was so upsetting. It's very. I mean, it was a book first, and I can't even imagine reading the book. It would be. Too much. I'm very delicate. I can't deal with anything. Okay. So, lightening it up a little bit and talking about delicious chicken dishes. So, there was a chef who had been he had been working for Mughal emperors. And then after Britain took over, after there was no official royalty in India anymore, he started working in five-star hotels in India. And he told everyone that chicken tikka masala was an authentic Mughal recipe. And he said that it came from the tradition in that area of being like slightly nomadic and taking food out with you. And they would eat highly spiced food, especially chicken. I guess there were wild chickens, perhaps. And they would spice them up as a method of preservation.
Preservation, yeah.
Yeah. And that's where it came from. But then... other people, like quote-unquote food experts, this one guy, Rahul Verma, said that he first had the dish, he first came across the dish, not until 1971, which would have been way after all the former emperor's cooks would have died.
Yeah.
And he was like, this has to be Punjabi. So I think what we find always is that when there is a food item that is wild delicious, everyone's eager to take credit for it.
Absolutely, yeah. Happens in every country.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know that when I've studied mole, like literally everyone was like, oh, that was totally our idea.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that is that no one's necessarily wrong.
No, it's just different versions. There's literally, you can have the same black mole made by 20 women and they all taste different.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Mexico didn't have, like, onions and garlic aren't indigenous to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
We gave Italy tomatoes.
Yeah.
And that's what people kind of don't know that much. So it's like, tomatoes are actually indigenous. It's an indigenous fruit to Mexico. So it's just everyone fucked everyone. Move vegetables around.
Totally. It is sometimes weird to look at the history of the world through food because you're like, yay, banh mi. But how did banh mi come to be? Because French people were being awful in Southeast Asia. It's weird. And sometimes I feel like it makes food historians seem really like glib about things. I know that for me, I'm like, I'm not trying to make it cute. what happened.
Yeah.
But we're talking about these dishes because people like eating them so much.
Yeah. And well, did you hear what I mentioned when I got here about the pozole? Like, do you want the PC version or the regular version where it involves cannibalism?
I mean, have you been studying pozole for a project? Well,
the whole restaurant concept is on regionality through a historical aspect. So the cultures that actually landed in the ports in Mexico and brought their rough sacks of like spices. So you get the Afro-Cuban and the Yucatan that we wouldn't have. Gingers, we use it in a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a special rice cake type of dish that's in Oaxaca.
Yeah.
Comes from the Chinese immigrants when they came down after the railroads. They immigrated to Mexico because during World War II, everyone that looked of Asian descent mm-hmm. was getting locked up in internment camps. So we have Chinese influence from TJ, wouldn't be TJ, Mexicali, wouldn't be Mexicali, all the way to Oaxaca. And it's really cool. I'm a historic, like, history buff nerd.
Uh-huh.
So I look up the last from, like, the Mayan rule to the Italians that landed in the 1800s and brought us fideo, you know.
Oh,
so
my
it's,
gosh.
It's a really cool experience to like research it on that.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Mexican food, it's we don't cook Mexican food. We cook mestiza, which is a blend of you grab this, you grab a little of this, and mm-hmm. yeah, what you got in your sack, I'll take that, and mm-hmm. it turns into our flavors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wouldn't have al pastor or adobada if it wouldn't have been for the lamb shawarma that
yeah.
landed in Puebla.
Yeah.
You know, and they eat it with pita bread.
Yeah.
In Puebla to this day, they have the tacos árabes, you know, so it's, Mexico's cool like that.
Yeah.
It yeah is. They don't forget where all these things come from.
Oh, that is so interesting.
Yeah.
I was doing some studying on quote unquote Native American food mm-hmm. a year or two ago, and someone like just about knocked my eyebrows off where they were like, you know that Mexican food is indigenous food, right? And I was like, oh yeah.
Well, then you go into what is indigenous
food? I know.
You know, like turkey in the Yucatan it's a big staple.
Yeah.
Protein.
Mm-hmm.
Pigs. The carnitas that everyone raves about, no, they came on boats.
Yeah.
The Spaniards said, stop eating each other, and here's some animals. So, yeah.
Yeah. Getting back to the pozole, you're saying that it was, so it must have been, it was cannibal, like they were eating
yeah.
humans.
Yeah.
It had to have been a ritual food then.
Yeah, of sorts. They would sacrifice, someone would die, and it was a preservation.
Like it was like a,
I gotta eat something.
A money saving
yeah.
thing?
No, seriously? Nothing goes to waste.
That's a bit much.
Well, that's why I said, do you want the PC version?
Oh, boy. Long pig. So good. That's really gross.
Yeah.
And but I feel comfortable saying that. Like,
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't eat it. It's not my thing, to each their own, but I get it. If you don't have anything, you know, in those parts of Mexico where there was no wild animals.
So were they murdering people for it? Or is it like if someone died immediately, you'd butcher yeah. the body? Okay, well that actually like,
it was a ritual. It was like a sacrifice if they would give themselves up. Or, you know, well, yeah, you look a little chunky. Maybe I'll be good on soup.
So there was murder involved? That's where I draw the line. I feel like ethical.
Well, I think we call it murder, but they don't call it murder. They didn't call it murder. Does that make sense?
Like, well, if you don't want to get in trouble, you don't call it murder. That's very convenient.
Stabby, stabby.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Ugh, okay. I actually, like, get so grossed out so easily. And I'm kind of waiting for the day when I vomit all over one of Michelle's mics. I'm going to get in so much trouble when that day comes, but I feel like it could actually happen.
Well, the best part is when people talk about how much they love, Americans love going to Tulum or, you know, the Yucatan, and they, oh my God, it's like this super hip thing and mm-hmm. everything is crazy expensive. When I got there, I was like, I wouldn't pay half this price. Like, Americans need to leave this place for a little bit so they can yeah. like realize that, you know, it's Mexico. But the cenotes, where the caves, that's mm-hmm. where they would do human sacrifices. So at the very, very bottom of almost every cenote, you can probably guarantee there's a whole slew of bones.
My human toes bones, are baby literally bones. Curling. Because those are huge tourist yeah. things, is to yeah. go diving in those. Do they dive yeah. or just snorkel?
You can dive. Some of them are crazy deep. But, you know, to the Mayans, that's how they appeased their gods. So I'm not going to knock it. I mean, to each their own, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, but it scares the bejesus out of me.
I love history. Like, that's, I'm amazed by it.
I feel like you're especially into, like, kind of goth history.
Yeah. Type stuff. I am a little morbid.
Fair enough. We actually did an episode earlier with a mortician.
Oh, cool.
You should listen to it. I think you would be into it. We talked about cannibalism there, too.
I follow this doctor, PhD doctor on Instagram, Lindsay Fritz. Uh-huh. She talks about like the science of medieval surgeries.
Ooh,
so
nasty.
She posts like super like interesting facts about the beginning of medical surgeries and how you were awake and they'd cut your arm off or your leg off. We went really, really dark here.
I think her name is Lindsay Fitzsimmons.
Yes. Oh my gosh, she's super smart. Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. If the mic didn't pick that up, Michelle says it's Lindsay Fitzsimmons and her book is The Butchering Art. If anyone wants to check that out. Which, why not?
I mean, I butcher things for a living, so it's like there's a kind of a connection.
Yeah, parallel. No, I totally think there is. I also just was thinking about how many baby Hannibal Lecters we have listening to this episode right now being like, yes, say more.
The Chianti, holding a Chianti.
Oh, no. Okay, let's talk about chicken again. So there was this guy who moved from India to London in the early 70s. Well, no. I don't know when he moved, but by the early 70s, he was the owner of a very hip restaurant. And he said that when he first got to London, he was served chicken tikka masala. And he was like, well, what is this? Because like he had been told it was Indian food. He's like, I don't know that it is. So it is true that chicken tikka masala really was popularized in England, or in Scotland, so anywhere in the UK. But I think that a thing that we do a lot is we confuse inventing and popularizing.
Yeah.
I've talked about this in episodes before. They're two different things, but mm-hmm. lots of times whoever made it trendy gets credit for creating it.
Yeah. And I'm sure what it tastes like in actual, like in their native land, is nothing like it tastes once it gets popularized. It's impossible.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I would bet
the ingredients are different.
Yeah, I would bet that the British version uses a lot more of the dairy.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Like a heavy cream.
Like
vibe.
A tomato bisque. Yes. Yeah, like a tomato bisque.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I recently went to LA County isn't known for Indian food, really. And I went to this one restaurant. It's down by Long Beach. It's called Al Noor, and people say that it is incredible. And I went there and it really was. It was really probably the best Indian food I've ever had in my life. Wow. And the chicken tikka masala was orange, not red. And I was like, I bet that's some kind of authentic thing. But like, maybe they add a little bit of ketchup like they used to do with pad thai in Thai restaurants in America to appease our dumb palates. And now I'm finally getting the real thing. And it's amazing. There was a woman, a cook working in London. She was of Indian descent in the 1950s. She went by the name Mrs. Balbir Singh, and she's often called like the Julia Child of British Indian cooking. And she put chicken tikka masala in one of her cookbooks. So she is British Indian, and I feel like that's how you could describe chicken tikka masala too.
British Indian.
British Indian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brindian.
Brindian. Inith? Yeah, I don't know. She had also earlier published a book where she had a dish called, I don't know how it's really pronounced, Shahi chicken masala. And that one was a lot sweeter. It had coconut in it, kind of like the way that you uh-huh. make it. And then it also had like cashews and almonds. And I feel like you do sometimes get chicken tikka masala here that has like ground up almonds yeah. in it or almond paste, but hers sounds like it was like specifically meant to be kind of a sweeter flavor profile.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Cashews in Spanish are nuez de la India. So, yeah. So it's specifically, we consider it a specific nut that comes from India.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I was just having a lot of thoughts about cashews the other night, and I think I like them best when they're roasted unsalted.
They're super good and fatty and delicious. Mm-hmm. I have the cashew butter. I used to moonlight as a paleo nut butter maker. a random side business, and the cashew butter was a pain in the ass. I went through 4 different food processors, random side note.
Oh my gosh.
Because they just beat the crap out of it. It would melt the inside of the food processor.
That sounds like an expensive business to have. Those things they're not cheap equipment.
No, but you also can charge $20 for an 8-ounce jar and people will be like, this is great.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. It's really smart as a food person to really grab on to food trends.
Yeah.
As long as you understand that it's a trend and you're nimble and you can switch to something else as soon as Gwyneth Paltrow stops writing about it or whatever, you know? Like, because people will spend so much money on whatever food is trendy at a given time. So part of the reason that British people were so into Indian food in the mid-1900s is because they had been eating it since 1809 when the first Indian restaurant opened in the UK. It was called the Hindustan Coffee House, which is a funny name that wouldn't fly now, but it's what the guy who was Indian, he founded it, and that's what he called it. And so people were familiar with the idea and the concepts and the flavors of Indian foods. And then, you know, starting in the 1950s, when people were actually had built up the funds to escape the partition, if that's what they wanted to do, and so many of them moved to the UK, people just became more and more familiar with it in the UK. And the term there, when you're ordering food in, is like to get a curry. Mm. So I don't.
Everything's just a blanket curry.
Yeah.
Like chai.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. When they, a lot of people, I think, when they talk about going out for Indian food or whatever, they'll just say curry, and that's like the shorthand or the other way of putting it. British people consume 2.5 billion pounds of chicken tikka masala every year. They're super into it.
I mean, it's really good.
Yeah.
I'm not going to. Yeah. I'd rather have tikka masala than spotted dick. Oh. Not the dessert. I mean,
yeah. Okay. Agreed on both counts. Dang. And I think part of the reason why chicken tikka masala is so popular is because, of course, those flavor profiles are more closely aligned with Punjabi food. And Punjabi Indians make up about 60% of all the Indians living in the UK. So they're the majority of that minority. So it's most of the food, just like in America.
Yeah.
It's the type of stuff that we're familiar with. In 2001, the British Foreign Secretary at the time, he was giving a speech and he was praising how multicultural Britain was. And he said, "Chicken tikka masala is now a true British national dish, not only because it is the most popular, but because it is a perfect illustration of the way Britain absorbs and adapts external influences." What do you think about that?
Steals, rape, pillages, burns.
I feel like he was purposefully forgetting how England got to the point where they were so classy and sophisticated.
Yeah, exactly.
They had to do a lot of evil.
Yeah.
To know that much about food.
Yes. No, they. I mean, Indian culture didn't say, "You can have our dish here. You take it. Run mm-hmm. with it." No. Mm-hmm. No.
I know. Well, I mean, we get the food. So that's cool.
Yeah.
I think we can pretty much establish that anytime a group of humans has power over another group of humans, they're awful mm-hmm. to each other. That seems to be our only constant.
Par for the course.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know what the answer is. Like, over time you forget and that's okay. I don't know. Or probably what most people would say is, why are you thinking this deeply on it?
Yeah. Why don't you close your book and think of the last 5 years?
Yeah, exactly.
Or yesterday.
Exactly. It's true. Well, I think it's really interesting. I mean, you must be absolutely surrounded by the same thoughts and ideas that I am doing the work that I do, because your restaurant is like based on the exact same idea.
Yeah. I mean, I'm constantly learning things that I still like. Yesterday, I sat on the phone, like, talked to my aunt about the history of our family in the restaurant. And it was like, the more I learn, I'm like, okay, I want to learn more. Like, it never stops.
Yeah.
You know, you can never stop learning.
Yeah.
That's especially food. True. There's
always something new.
I mean, you got to eat. And people make the best food during the worst times.
Yeah.
If you think of all the best dishes, they came through really hard, difficult times. Yeah. You know, and I mean, more power to every culture that kind of rises through that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm stoked that right now, America is confused right now. There's a lot of really evil things happening right now. But in some places like California, we're also like, oh, dope. Things we've never tried before. Like, let's find out more. Yeah. I'm into it. So that's nice.
The People's Republic of California.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I'm feel lucky to live here. So you buy August, people will definitely be able to come eat at your restaurant. I know you're supposed to open.
Oh, by May. If I'm not open by at least the middle of May, I'm killing someone. Okay. I'm putting them in the pozole for sure.
Yeah, that. Oh my God. Your first customers are going to be like, I don't know if I want it. I'm nervous. you open two on time?
Is this a shoelace?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Awesome. Well, where can people follow you and keep tabs on how the restaurant's coming along?
On Instagram, I'm the most active. So it's at Claudette Zepeda Wilkins. Sorry, it's so long. If you put Claudette, I'll pop up in, somewhere in there. And then on Twitter, at Claudette Zepeda. Twitter kind of scares me. I don't really know how it works. I'm not of the Twitter generation.
Instagram is where it's at right now.
Yeah. I do a lot of stories.
There you go.
So.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I'm excited to come down there and try your food soon.
I'm excited to have you guys. Thanks.
Thank you.